Case for argument, United States versus Woods, Ms. Christensen.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Joanna Christensen. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Charles Woods in this matter.
I just have an irrelevant question.
But
I noticed throughout your brief, you referred to your client as Mr. Woods.
Yes.
But everybody else doesn't get a Mr. or Miss. Rogers, Roberson, Davis, White, they're just, you know, by their last names. So I wondered whether, you know, Woods belongs to some superior social class, or what is this exactly?
Well, Your Honor, he is my client, but I don't think that makes necessarily him a superior social class. It's basically a stylistic decision based on the fact that there were...
You want to use my members of this court as well, so if you're in sound...
My
members of this court as well on occasion, so you're in sound ground.
So you want him to look more respectable than the... FBI agents and so on.
Of course, Your Honor.
Okay, fine, all right. So I understand the purpose.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay. Mr. Woods' constitutional right to confront David Roberson, who is a paid FBI confidential informant, was violated in this case, where the district court allowed audio tapes of Roberson during a controlled buy to be admitted at trial when Roberson was not called to testify at trial. To clarify the record, or the brief a little bit in this matter, the government seems to be under the impression that I'm only contesting the conversation between Mr. Woods and Roberson, and that is actually not the fact as to this issue. I'm contesting the entire body of the tapes that involved Mr. Roberson, including the conversation with Mr. Woods, the conversation with Mr. Rogers, and what I've termed the monologue statements where Roberson is basically talking to himself or talking to the agents. As this court is aware, there's an exception to the Confrontation Clause where statements are admitted for their context and not for the truth of the matter asserted. And in this case, the district court said it was admitting these statements as mere filler. However, misinstructed the jury that and didn't mention that they were not to consider these statements for their truth. Even though the government argued at a sidebar we're not admitting these for the truth, the district court actually disagreed and said, well, I don't know about that, and then proceeded to instruct the jury simply that they were mere filler and not that they were not to be considered for their truth, which Mr. Woods contends is error. Secondly, the government has failed to address the Burton case of this court in that where this court held that where the government relies on the statements as truth at trial, even if it's protesting that they are doing so, it cannot be under this exception to the Confrontation Clause. This case is almost identical to Burton in that matter. The government relied on all of Roberson's statements, both in opening statements and closing arguments and during the trial. Finally, I'd like to, as to this issue, quickly address the harmless error. The government didn't address this, but I want to make sure that I argue this. Admission of these tapes cannot be considered harmless error in this matter. They were nearly the sole substantive evidence presented about count one. Without these tapes, there would not have been a conviction obtained on count one, as to Mr. Woods. Moving on to our second issue, which is the hearsay issue, which is an alternative argument to the Confrontation Clause issue, the district court abused its discretion by admitting the multiple hearsay statements on audio tapes, both of David Roberson and of Orlando Davis. The court relied primarily in post-trial hearings on this court's recent decision in United States versus Ruiz, which involved present sentence impression exception to the hearsay rule. I'll address David Roberson's statements first. Under the present sense impression exception to the hearsay rule. Statements can be admitted if they meet certain factors that this court discussed in Ruiz. The factor that we're contesting is that the statements describe an event without calculated narration. Robertson's statements in this case can only be described as calculated narration. He was making statements simply to assure that he was successful, and the FBI knew he was successful in his endeavors to get Mr. Woods in this case. He constantly assured the agents that it's going down, it's going to happen, he'll be here in 8 minutes, he's coming, I called him. And then when things weren't going as planned, when they weren't catching the guy they thought they were going to, he said what was going wrong. The one thing that went wrong was that Melvin Rogers came instead of Charles Woods. I believe, and Mr. Woods believes, that this is calculated narration designed to implicate Mr. Woods. And therefore, the district court abused its discretion by admitting these statements under the present sense impression doctrine. Furthermore, Ruiz relies on the fact that the witness in that case was subject to cross-examination, and therefore that the possible error in admitting these statements was lessened by that. And of course, I'd remind the court that because Robertson was unavailable at the time of trial, he was not subject to any kind of cross-examination. The jury knew very little about his background, knew very little about him personally, and there was no ability for the defense to attempt to impeach him in any way. Moving on to Orlando Davis and the statements regarding the August transaction.
Well, is it your argument the government couldn't use any portions of these tapes?
With regard to the hearsay argument?
With regard to anything.
The second argument, with regard to hearsay, there are essentially three parts of each of these tapes: the conversation with Mr. Woods, the monologue statements, and then the conversation with whoever came to deliver the drugs, either Melvin Rogers or Tawanda White. And as far as hearsay, basically, because the first conversation with Woods and then the last conversation fall in within exceptions, the first being adoptive admissions or admissions of a party opponent, and the second being co-conspirator statements, it's really the middle statements, the monologue statements, that we're contesting as far as hearsay.
So you're not saying the tapes had to be excluded in their entirety?
Not because of hearsay, Your Honor.
Because of something else?
Well, David Robertson's tapes were arguing kind of an alternative argument, first being that they should have been excluded because of a confrontation clause violation, and if the court does not agree with us on that one, secondly, that his monologue statements should have been excluded because they were pure hearsay that did not fall within any recognized exception. And then as far as Orlando Davis, it's really just the monologue statements that we're talking about.
And the monologue, what would be an example of something particularly damaging to your client?
I believe the monologue statements as to Davis include some of these background statements about he's coming, I'm paging him, but the most damaging ones are Chuck sent his girl, which directly implicates Mr. Woods, who's called Charles and Chuck other times. And also, that the statement that he made to the agent, to Rogers, that has nothing to do with anything, that says last time Melvin shorted me. And that really doesn't need to be in there.
Who said that?
Mr. Davis did on August 9th, referring to a previous transaction with Melvin Rogers. He said it into the phone.
But how does that hurt Woods?
The government relied on that statement to show against the defense's theory that it was Melvin Rogers directing all of these drug transactions, that it was actually Mr. Woods and could not have been Melvin Rogers. And that was pure monologue statements, because the other side of the conversation wasn't being recorded in that manner. From the government's brief, I believe it can be conceded error because they don't argue any of these arguments. They don't address Ruiz in their brief at all, so I'm assuming, or the court can assume, that they're admitting the error as to these statements, but argue it's harmless. And again, similar to my Confrontation Clause argument, these types of statements cannot be considered harmless. The government relied on them almost exclusively in its rebuttal argument, referring to the tapes as the cake, to the witnesses, the live witnesses, icing on the cake, saying that the witnesses, it's okay if you don't believe them. What really matters are the audio tapes. And those are the icing on the cake. And I think when the government, whose burden it is to show that these statements are harmless error, entry of these statements are harmless error, when they rely on them heavily, they cannot be harmless error. I believe that I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless the court has any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Bass?
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, let me first emphasize that all of these objections with respect that are raised on appeal with respect to these tape recordings are waived. They're not just forfeited, they're waived. I would urge the Court, because particularly because the government went into great detail in the statement of facts, to go to show how these issues that are raised on appeal were non-issues at trial. Now, the defendant, I met with counsel for the defendant who was different at trial than on appeal prior to trial, went over these tapes and transcripts, and the representation was no objection. And we get to trial, and at the moment that we were ready to play these tapes and publish them to the jury, then there was an objection raised. And prior to trial, in addition, counsel advised the district court, we concede that the government does not can put on these tapes for someone other than the informant. Now that's not just forfeiture, that's waiver. And then when we get to trial and just as we're ready to publish them to the jury, then there's an objection. There was a general hearsay objection, but if you go on and look at the record in the dialogue with the district court, counsel for the defendant says to Judge Mim, there's only a couple of statements in here and I don't necessarily want to keep them out. Now that's waiver. And the only statement, the only one that was objected to at trial was this statement, Melvin shorted me last time. And the government's use of that at trial was not hearsay. We didn't introduce that to prove that Melvin shorted somebody. We simply made the argument that if Mr. Davis is talking to someone and said, Melvin shorted me, it's at least a reasonable inference that the person he's talking to is not Melvin. That is a non-hearsay purpose for that recording. Now, with respect to the confrontation clause argument, if the court disagrees with the government and finds forfeiture instead of waiver, this court has said on three occasions, at least, that tape-recorded statements between a defendant and someone else can be adoptive admissions and admissible for the truth, and that's exactly what we have here. The conversation between Mr. Roberson and the defendant was a negotiation of a drug transaction. Can I get what I put in there? Yeah. For $475, yeah. That's an entirely adopted statement by the defendant.
Well, what do you mean adopted? What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, under the rules of evidence, if a person manifests an adoption or a belief in the truth of the declarant's statement, then he becomes the declarant. And that's what happened. As to the recording between the defendant and Mr. Roberson.
How did he manifest his belief in the truthfulness of what the other person was saying?
Well, what Mr. Roberson was asking the defendant, Your Honor, was could he purchase drugs for $475?
Doesn't the whole conversation win if the defendant himself is participating in it?
Well, Your Honor, there's two bases for admission. One is for the truth. One is for context. Oh. So the truth is, if the defendant manifests an adoption of
adopting the guy talking to him?
Your Honor, if a person says, can I buy drugs from you for $475, you've adopted, not only do you say yes, but you've adopted
the whole
conversation
was in anyway. It doesn't make any difference one way or another. I don't have to adopt it, just the acknowledgement that I'm engaged in a contractual discussion with you.
And it's admissible for the truth, Your Honor. It's an adoptive admission.
That's all my question was. Well, not adoptive. It's conversation between the two that goes in as a conversation.
Yes.
You can't separate it and say, he's adopting this. Or
but, Your Honor, the
if he said, what do you mean by something for me? I'm in a grocery business, not the drug business. You wouldn't have offered the tape. So that
that's right, Your
Honor. Take care of that problem.
The adoption comes in because the defendant's statements themselves are obviously admissions.
Yeah.
But the issue is, what about the declarant statements?
And if the it's part of the conversation.
That's right. Are they admissible for the truth? If the defendant adopts the statements or manifests a
well,
belief.
I don't know. It seems awful. I think I have a question with Judge Bowers. A statement of a party is admissible because it's his statement.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So, but if the statement consists of the answer to a question, you obviously have to have the question. Otherwise, the answer doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
you can't
exactly.
You can't just say, Wood said yes. That's an admission.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. So, but that's the context.
Yes to what?
That's
right.
That's the context.
You don't talk about adoption. You just talk about the conversation. Right. Let it go with that. I'm just arguing with your semantics. There's nothing to do with your argument.
Your Honor, I don't want to make this issue any more difficult than it is because it's a non-issue. The statements of Mr. Roberson were admissible on two grounds. One for the truth of the matter asserted, and one not for the truth of the matter asserted, but just to show the context of the defendant's statements. And to the extent that this court said in Burton that a limiting instruction must be given by the district court, we made every effort to have that instruction given. The defendant didn't want one, and therefore any issue as to instruction is also waived. Now, I want to get to these monologue statements. The government doesn't concede any error on those statements. What I did was in the second section of my brief address those as one. And again, these objections are waived. There's only one objection to one statement at trial, which was equivocal. There's only a couple statements in here, and I don't necessarily want to keep them out. Everything that's argued before you today in the defendant's brief and by counsel today is all new. They're all new arguments.
Okay, let's hear everyone, but okay, now, but Ms. Christensen gave as an example, Chuck sent the girl. Now, is that admissible under any basis?
Your Honor, those are the statements that I would concede, in hindsight, should not have been admitted. But if you look at the government's response to the defendant's motion for new trial, that was never raised by the defendant in his motion for new trial. The government, on its own, raised that to Judge Mim and said, Your Honor, in hindsight, if we had to do this over again, we wouldn't have admitted them. But the fact that they were erroneously...
You wouldn't have offered it.
We wouldn't have offered it, correct.
The judge admits it.
That's right, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Get it set.
But that doesn't end the inquiry, because the statements by Mr. Woods, Chuck and his girl, that was Chuck, Mr. Woods testified, or Mr. Davis testified, and he said that he talked with the defendant, that he paged the defendant, that was who he talked to on the phone, that it was the defendant who told him he was sending a girl to deliver the drugs. So this evidence about Mr. Davis saying Chuck, or Chuck sent his girl, is cumulative. And that's exactly
Did you argue? So you're saying it's a harmless error.
It's a harmless error, Your Honor. And we never made reference to those statements during the trial in terms of closing argument. My argument was based on what Mr. Davis testified to as to who he spoke to on the phone, what the defendant said, and what happened. And this court said in Godinez and Johnson, both authored by Judge Bauer, those statements were harmless.
Actually, that was human to the court.
Authored by yourself, Your Honor, and I believe one Johnson was joined in by Judge Posner. But the point here is that these statements were cumulative. There was nothing new offered to the jury in these statements. Mr. Davis testified as to what happened, so there was no substantial prejudice to the defendant. And let me make one point with respect to the argument about newly discovered evidence. This was not newly discovered evidence, as Judge Mim found. The focus on the newly discovered evidence test is not on the new evidence, but on the false testimony. Did the false testimony take the defendant by surprise, or was the defendant unable to counter that testimony? The testimony that was given by Mr. Rogers was presented to the defendant prior to trial in the form of an FBI interview report. So there's no way that the defendant can now stand before you and say that he was taken by surprise or unable to counter that testimony. And even if they surpassed that hurdle, there's no basis to conclude that Mr. Rogers' testimony was false. It was corroborated, and so we would submit that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion for new trial, and for those reasons, Your Honor, the United States would ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bass. Ms. Christensen, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
May it please the court. I think with my 1 minute, I'll try and address some of the government's arguments. But first, most importantly, is the waiver argument. Waiver has been defined by the United States Supreme Court as intentional relinquishment of a known right. And I don't believe that exists in this case. If anything, we're talking about a forfeiture, which is a failure to make a timely objection. And as far as the hearsay argument, there were objections pre-trial, during trial, and post-trial, which were all discussed and argued and ruled upon by the district court. And that, I think, is enough to put it squarely within this court's review, and there is no waiver here or forfeiture. As far as the Confrontation Clause issue, I think that's a stickier issue for this court because, admittedly, it was not perfectly raised at trial in that trial counsel did not mention once the Confrontation Clause. However, all of the arguments at trial revolved around Roberson and the fact that he was not going to be at trial to testify and the problems with the admission of his testimony through audio tape.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and we thank the defender for, you know, undertaking the argument and, defending your client with great vigor.